Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, March 29th, 2007. A lot of material to cover tonight, so I'll be talking as fast as I can because I know I can't get all of this information in one short hour. At any rate, I did pre-record today, this midday, with a show with Pam Stegner, a show that I used to be on quite a bit couple years ago. And Pam invited me back on to her show called Preparedness Now. And the website for her site is preparedness, just like it sounds, .com. And I think she said her site is down at this time. So I expect that to be back up in a couple days. But she broadcasts out of a couple stations in New York City. WASB is one of them. And so Sunday night, this pre-recorded show for 1 hour will air 7 p.m. Eastern Time if you're in the Rochester or Upper Eastern New York area, WASB Radio in New York, 7 p.m. Eastern Time Sunday. And by next week, Pam said she would have that show archived. We talked about the Prime Number book, which for the first half, and then we started talking about water and the water issues. Now, this is something Pam Stegner has been working on for many years also, so we had a pretty nice conversation about the various intrusions on your life that are going on regarding water, the control of water, ownership of water, who is moving in to take control of water, and then we had some conversations offline also. But it's just incredible the amount of movement going on in the world, the large entities, the money people buying up and taking control of land that basically controls water. Now, you know, this is a show about science, and I keep harping on this water issue. None of these people that are in these large controlling interests in the world, none of these people could do any of this if it weren't for scientists out there running around, getting a paycheck, and doing the bidding for these people. In the case of this, geologists identifying the water resources and just doing their job, not having a clue what damage their information is doing to the human population of this planet. It allows people in the UN who control the UN, people who control everything down to your local government, to start taking control of water, the most important thing you use as a human being, the most important thing you use every day. And I put a posting up on my page. It was a quote from Fortune magazine. It said something, I'll paraphrase it, but essentially they said that water will be to the 21st century as oil was to the 20th century. Now, think about that statement for a minute. It tells you a number of things. Large corporations who look at investments are moving into the water industry. Who owns water? Why should anybody own water? And why should they be able to get into the distribution chain? And as with oil, as they learned very well with oil, the distribution chain is where you make your money, in the transport and limiting the amount of water that can get to the public. Let me give you a little example. One stroke of the pen of federal legislators in the United States, and I believe it was actually our good friend Billy Clinton, not really my good friend, I'm saying that in jest, of course, signed a bill changing the allowed requirement for arsenic in public water wells from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion. This effectively shut down many wells across the country with a single stroke of the pen. The water didn't change. People had been drinking this water for decades, for probably even longer. And all of a sudden, with a stroke of a pen, wells were rendered useless. Now, just imagine the consequences of knowing, for example, the data that is provided by the cities. They all want to be, compliant and turn in their test results for their wells. Can you imagine having access to that data and some computer guy is crunching the data for you and your question is, what factor, what chemical trace element in water could we change the ratings for, the allowable amounts of this trace element in water, and affect the most number of wells in the country to shut them down and not allow public use of them anymore? Can you imagine the person with that kind of information? Now, there is a symbol that the TIA organization once had. Remember the Total Information Awareness outfit that wanted control of all information, whether it was your medical records or the number of times you went to the bathroom per day? They wanted everything in a computer database on everybody. TIA, Total Information Awareness. And of course, Congress didn't allow it and it simply went underground and it's still operating. But their symbol was a pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top and the little saying in Latin, power is knowledge. And you could turn that around, of course, Latin, you could say that either way. Power is knowledge or knowledge is power. In other words, if you have knowledge, then you can maneuver to use that information to affect how you maintain power. And that's very much the case in the water world, where control of water is at hand. Control of the distribution of water. There, I've talked about this before, placing radio transmitters in your house that do one thing, they read your water usage down to the last drop, but they also will allow someone with the device to read that, and that can be hacked into by unsuspecting people with nefarious purposes. But imagine your city or government entity having access to that information. They can tell if you're home, how many people are home, if you're not home, and they can tell all kinds of things about you by simply monitoring your water usage. They can tell when your kids are there and the adults are not there, because adults use different things in the house, typically laundry. You can tell when the laundry washing machine is being used, and the showers. So, for example, when kids come home from school, they wash their hands and get a drink of water. Their patterns of usage are different than those of adults who come home and do the dishes or turn on the dishwashing machine or something like that. So, basically, you can tell a lot about who's in a house simply by monitoring their water usage. Isn't that cute? So now they have a remote reader that'll read your water usage in your house. And before, remember, you only had to go out once every 3 months and have your water read, and there's a little number, and they charge you by the thousands of gallons. So why is it so important all of a sudden to be able to read your water usage down to the last drop? Well, you're starting to get the picture, because pretty soon, everybody out there, you're going to be buying your water by the gallon. And there may be limitations. If all of a sudden a federal edict comes down and says 2 out of 3 of your local water wells and water tanks can no longer be used, there's going to be water rationing and a controlled water shortage. I don't want to spend the whole show talking about this, but this is such a huge topic. Get wise to what's going on in your local community and go to the web pages that talk about the horror stories. Atlanta, Georgia, turning its water system over to a private entity only to have an absolute disaster on its hands. The one of the largest water-using cities in the country, Atlanta, Georgia, and you can read about that on the internet, along with many other patterns of large entities moving in to take over water resources, putting water meters and remote water reading capabilities on wells, on people's home usage, etc. Okay, next topic. To Calculate Prime's book, I just want to give a little review of what happened. It was half sold out before people even knew the title. I had to put a link up on my page because people were just sending money to the mail order address. They said, I don't know how much the book is or even what the title or topic is, but I know I want it. And so to stop that flurry of activity, I put the link up 5 days before the book was released, the name and title and topic. And in that 5 days before the title was released, half of the first printing had already sold out. This is incredible. So the second printing, it was clear that that would have to happen very soon. And before the first week and a half was out, the first printing had finally totally sold out. So anyway, the second printing is at hand, and we will, as they say with the potato chip commercial, we'll make more. But so the second printing is now available, and it's hard to say when we will be going into a third printing, but something else happened that surprised me, and that is all of my books sold out during that past week. And I'm somewhat in shock for a couple reasons, just due to the fan response of the overall interest in the books, it said in all of the books. But this also provides me with somewhat of an interesting dilemma. I have five books that all of a sudden are all entering reprinting at the same time. So that's somewhat of a shock. The Surviving Planet X pamphlet just came out of, I think, its seventh printing, and the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes is now going into its eighth or ninth printing. I'm losing track of how many these have been printed. Atlantis to Tesla, I believe, is going into its fifth printing, and the weather book, Principia Meteorologia, we actually printed the first two printings 1.5 times normal, and those, of course, are all sold out, and that's going into its third printing as we speak. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make an offer, and I'll give more details of this, but I'm prepping you to be ready for this. I think I'm going to sell possibly, I'm not sure how many sets, but it'll be somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 sets, and it'll be two complete sets of all my books, and of course the Prime Number book includes the DVD. And I'm working on now my a DVD lecture series, and the first lecture of specific topics. Now I have a whole set of topics that the DVDs will be discussing, and these will be for a wide range, everything from people who are laymen up to college professor level detailed material on my theoretical work. And it's something that's been in the work for a long time and is finally coming to fruition. So the first of that, probably about 12 to 15 DVD set, is going to be out and available in this first special offer. So here is what you would get. Two complete sets of all my books, plus the first DVD in the lecture series, and I think it's going to come in at around $100, which is almost half price. And so I'm still working out all the numbers and the details. I don't have all of that yet, but it'll be posted on my webpage. And here's what I would like you to do. I'm going to specify who I would like you to give that second set to. And, of course, these will go all over the country and all over the world, this limited edition not limited edition, but limited set, where you will get a very special price and two complete sets of brand new books. And I'm going to ask you to give them to a very specific group of people. So I'll talk more about that later, because I want these books in the hands of certain people. And at any rate, I'll talk more about that special offer coming up, so just stay tuned. And as you know, I offered, before the Calculate Primes book came out, I offered a special. I had found 56 issues of the weather book, first printing, and that was because that sold out fairly quickly. It was considered somewhat of a rarity, and we found a box hiding in a corner that had 56 of the weather book in it. And so I made an offer, the new book signed, both of them signed, and those 56 books with the Calculate Primes book signature, I signed them. Those sold out in about 2 days. So just to give you an idea how fast these can go, that's why I'm kind of giving you a warning to keep posted if you might be interested in this two sets of my books. Anyway, on to the next topic. France releases X-Files. Big story made major headlines around the world. France, in a surprise move, this past week released all of their files on UFO activity that they had been collecting over, decades and decades. I believe the earliest one was 1937, their first official logged UFO encounter story that was logged in their files. And of course, there were some outstanding ones, some that were not explainable by your average UFO. You know, a lot of times people see Venus or they're driving down the road, there are optical illusions. For example, some of the more common mistakes that people make when they are thinking they're seeing a UFO, they may be driving down the road and there's either Jupiter or Venus, very bright in the night sky, and they're driving down the road and there are the trees going by, and Venus or Jupiter, this very bright object up in the sky, seems to be moving along with them through the trees. And they think, wow, there's a UFO, when in reality it's not. It's just a planet. So there's many UFO cases that can easily and quickly be done away with. There wasn't a case, it was an explainable case, but there are many, many. They figure between 2 and 5% of unidentified flying object cases are not readily explainable through standard explanations. These are the ones that get into the files, and then teams of experts go out and start studying them. So at any rate, I want to talk a little bit. You can look at the X-Files. There's a website. I know you can find the link to that. I don't have it off the tip of my tongue here, but on the internet, and you can go in and look at France's, you know, decades worth of UFO files. And they asked the question, the reason they released that information to the public on a website was they would like input from the scientific community on UFOs, what makes them tick, and what's really going on here. And I just want to mention, too, there are people who have spent years, if not decades, pioneering this topic to the public. There's the Hynek who worked on the original Blue Book, which was an Air Force project, and then they found out that the real goal was to try and debunk all of the claims and send a message to the public that this didn't exist. And a guy named J. Allen Hynek started his own organization because he realized that the government entire purpose was to lie to the public. So he went out and studied this over decades and dedicated his life to this. So J. Allen Hynek was one of the original researchers, real researchers, in the study of UFOs. And there have been many people since. A guy who has interviewed me, his name is Whitley Strieber, who is a good friend of Art Bell's. Of course, they wrote the book, The Coming Global Superstorm, and which was made eventually into the movie Day After Tomorrow. Well, I've been on the Art Bell show where Whitley was one of the interviewing hosts. back in the old Hale-Bopp days. But and so he covers a wide range of topics, but of course Strieber was an author, a very well-acclaimed author of novels and mystery type books, very popular. And he started having encounters, and so he went public and he said, "We don't know what is going on here, but it has to be studied." So at any rate, there are people like Whitley Strieber who pioneered this topic, that the public needs to have some kind of explanation and not this garbage that was coming out of the government official sources, if you know what I mean. So at any rate, for France to release this information to the public was monumental, because if you remember, less than a year ago, the British government said it was going to release its files, and then they had some joker come out and say, "Well, we really don't have anything at all anyway, so there's nothing to release, so we're just not going to release anything." And the public is like, "Oh, brother, here we go, back to the old government BS again," which is literally what it is. But the interesting thing about the French release is that the encounters, the data that the French have, is similar to anything that's in the U.S. and in South America or Europe or Britain or whatever. They're all the same. So for one country to release all their files is very big, because now it minimizes the other countries who are still holding on to these vast files and databases on the UFO phenomenon. Now, I want to talk specifically on this show about how flying saucers work. And this is an area, as a scientist, that I have worked in the background. The military knows about this. In 1982, I was attending scientific meetings with the military, with the aerospace community, and I was giving talks on how flying saucers work due to electromagnetic propulsion systems. And that's something that I developed, and as I say, I talked about these openly. One of the shows, air shows that I was at, was called Aerospace America. I believe it was probably in about 1986. In San Diego, I gave a talk to a closed military group on this topic, and a guy named Bert Rutan was there. That's where I first met Rutan, and he was there with his composite structures that he was starting to enter into use for airframes. He was the first person really to use composites, and he was there showing his airframe parts that he was making. In some cases, replacement parts for existing aircraft, and then also completely independent designs of his own design of airplanes, the Rutan, early Rutan designs. So at any rate, I want to talk on the air tonight about the UFO designs that I was talking about and working on and passing information to aerospace companies in the 1982 to 1986 time frame. And of course that continued on, but I want to be specific to those years to show you what was known then. Okay, let's take what is typically called a flying saucer. If you take it apart, a flying saucer is a very stable airframe. And we know this, the average guy on the street has seen a Frisbee fly. Part of the Frisbee motion is the spinning. That gives you what is known as gyrostabilization, a technique that's used in many satellites for communications, for military, for aerospace exploration of the planets, etc. Gyrostabilization, you simply have a gyro or spinning wheel, typically, that stabilizes. And if you've ever taken a bicycle wheel, just take it off the bike, spin it, and then try and move it, move the axis, the axle, and you'll see that there's that spinning wheel provides a very stable basis, a base. So gyrostabilization is an essential part of that disc. There are many high-performance automobiles that use gyrostabilization as a basis for stabilization. A lot of people don't know that. But at any rate, in that saucer-shaped object are wheels that are spinning, and there's a motor in there that keeps those wheels spinning, and that provides you with a very stable base for this very excellent disc-shaped airframe. Now, how do you make it go? What's the propulsion system on a UFO? And why does this propulsion system explain what we see, what is observed? And now, whether these are built by aliens or people on Earth, I'm not even going to go onto that topic because it could be one or the other or both, and I'm not going to even touch that topic. I'm just going to tell you how they work. The propulsion system is based on electromagnetic interactions. The Earth has a natural magnetic field. You can also generate artificial magnetic fields that look just the same physically or in the electromagnetic world. On the spacecraft or on the flying saucer device, you have glass or hardened tubes, insulator tubes. You run electrical currents through those tubes, and they push against the magnetic field of the Earth or an artificial magnetic field, causing the propulsion. Some people call this anti-gravity, but it's truly not anti-gravity. It is not an anti-gravity device. In other words, it's not through physics creating a gravity-related force. It is creating an electromagnetic force that pushes against the gravitational force that already exists. So, in other words, you're creating one type of force, just like propellers create a force to move an airplane. The tubes with the electrical current flowing through them causes a force against the magnetic field of the Earth, and that pushes you through the air, or it actually works in outer space. And that's why these vehicles are very versatile. They can do vertical takeoffs. You can move in very certain directions relative to the magnetic field, and all of these are understandable in terms of basic physics. These are driven by nuclear power cells that exist in the craft itself. So, basically, without going into a lot of detail, my Atlantis to Tesla book has one of the papers that was published in the journals, actually published in journals, and I have replicated that paper in the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. And the purpose of that was to relate ancient science to modern science. In other words, these craft and this basic design is fundamental to nature itself because magnetic fields exist in nature. They're naturally occurring. So, as with the prime numbers, if someone on the far side of the universe developed a propulsion system to go into space, eventually they would get rid of chemical rockets and they would go to electromagnetic propulsion systems. The reason being that chemical rockets are big and bulky, and you have to shoot some kind of material out of a nozzle at high temperature, at high velocity, to make it work. The ion engines, all the other types of engines you see commercially in use today for outer space are inertial engines. They throw something out a nozzle, they burn a fuel. There's various types of rocket fuels that have been developed, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, kerosene liquid oxygen, hydrogen peroxide, all kinds of bases of fuels. There have been nuclear designs where you heat up material based on nuclear reactions going on in the engine area of the rocket. All of them have the same type of philosophy. They are called inertial engines. In other words, they heat something up, throw it out a nozzle. The electromagnetic propulsion systems do not do that. So, at any rate, why does this explain what we see, the burnt ring area on the ground? Well, that's because there's a tremendous amount of heat involved. You have the nuclear reactors putting out a good deal of heat, the electrical currents moving, and part of the electrical current path, the return path, is around the skin of the craft, around the outside. So it's a very interesting design, and the part of the electrical current is on the outside of the craft itself. As I said, the design for this, one of the basic designs is shown in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. At any rate, so another visual effect is when people see these, they see somewhat like of a nebular glow around the spacecraft. There again, that's because there's a current flow between the spacecraft and the environment. That's not causing the spacecraft to go. It's part of the electrical current that is required as you send part of that electrical current through the tubes that I talked about. Then the return current goes around the outside of the spacecraft, and it ionizes the air, and you actually can see that. Sometimes you see like beading in the glass tubes, and people see that kind of as little beads of light moving around in the tubes. Those are called Newton's rings in physics, and it's a property of tubes. This, you can find this in like fluorescent tubes. As they burn out, they will have, as air enters that tube that is not the, say, neon or one of the other gases that you do want in there, as other gases enter the tube and the tube starts breaking down, you can see Newton's rings in the tube of a fluorescent light bulb, one of the long tube type fluorescent light bulbs. So that is what is happening in the tubes, and that's why you see that effect of the kind of the dancing lights going around the ring at the edge of the flying saucer. Another effect, the vertical takeoff, the spacecraft lifting up very rapidly and going out of sight. It's one of the more powerful ways of using this propulsion system. They can then move, they can stop, they can hover, they can drop and land. And once again, there's a lot of electrical activity around these. That's why, notably, they stay away from power lines, because high-tension power lines, high-voltage power lines, have a tremendous magnetic field associated with them. So a craft like this is very sensitive to magnetic fields, and so you certainly would not want to fly one anywhere near a powerful magnetic field, such as a high-power line. At any rate, there's more detail to this, but I just wanted to go into this because the people in France, if anybody in France is listening to this show, please direct your government or those people to the archive of my radio show, which is on the webpage, the jmccsci.com. That's JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. That website, and the Atlantis to Tesla book, of course, has that information there. And have them listen to this radio show, because this information is known. It simply has not been broadcast widely to the public. But these facts are known amongst physicists who are in the industry. And when I say in the industry, typically they don't talk outside of their own little cloistered circles. So in a nutshell, that's how flying saucers work. The details of this have been known. I introduced these topics in the early 1980s into the military and aerospace industry. So there was no secret about how these flying discs work, what the propulsion system is, and their capabilities. I'm going to quick go on to the next topic, which is the SpaceX rocket. Founder Elon Musk, who, of course, became wealthy with PayPal and then sold it, now is investing in a space program, is one of the groups trying to commercialize space, which I think is wonderful. The only problem I see is that it is not going to be done with rockets as they are trying to do. But that's okay because at least they're getting the ships off the ground. They're getting into suborbital flights. They're starting to book customers, and they're starting to pave the way just like the private industries did with the airlines. Remember that the Wright brothers' first plane was actually purchased by the military. And it was soon after that investors began to build a private airlines for transportation, for transporting people, etc. And the rest is history up to the 747 or the modern big planes that are flying 300 plus people around the world at a single time, going, you know, nonstop from a quarter away around the world on a single load of jet fuel. So there, I have mixed feelings about what's going on, but in general, thank goodness there are people with money out there who are putting it into these ventures to get this going. It actually forced the government to move and to remove some of the red tape so these people can bring this forth. The government had two choices. They either had to do something to allow this to happen, or these people would simply go elsewhere and do it anyway. Quick mention, I posted this on my webpage, but many people listen to the shortwave show, so I'm going to repeat this because it is so very important, even if you read it on the webpage. I call it Truth in Search Engine Reporting. Now, all of us know what a search engine is on the internet. You go to Google, Yahoo, and there's a bunch of other ones. Those are the most famous, of course. And you type in your topic, and then up pops lists and lists of websites that refer to that topic. And they can go out and search the billions of sites on the internet. This is all held in a giant database, and instantly you have back a whole list of websites to go to. The problem is that now people can pay to have their website listed high on the list. Or there's another problem, one that I've noted before, dealing with something called Wikipedia. Now, Wikipedia gets a lot of hits in general because it has so many topics. But let's say you search on the topic of comets. Wikipedia is probably not the most referenced site in the world when you want to look at comets. But why does it come up high? Because it gets so many references from everything else that people are searching on. So one of the false recordings in a search engine is pulling up a web page that has a lot of hits, not because of the topic you are searching on, but because of the topics that everybody else is searching on. So their collective hit rate is much higher because they have so many varying topics on their page, if you see what I mean. So they really shouldn't be ranked highly, say, if you search on comets. A site that really deals with comets should come up first. Also, there are government disinformation agents out there who are buying websites and using people's names. Like, if you search on my name, there are sites that come up. They're supported by the government, and their sole purpose is to badmouth me and try and lie about me. There's one site that claims that I have spent my life being a massage therapist. I have never made my living being a massage therapist. That is absolutely absurd when you look at the years I've taught in the university level, the years I've spent working in industry. And so, but we cannot get that page taken down, and there's no truth in reporting or accountability on the internet. So the internet is a big mess today. And one of the problems, one of the big problems, are the search engines. The search engines cater to people who will pay them to put their name up high on the list. And if they are targeting someone like me, then they can pay to have their disinformation site up there. And so what I've come up with is a rating system. When you do a Google search or otherwise on a topic, say you search on my name, then there should be a rating system there. Does this site really refer to this person? Is this by the person? Is it acknowledged by the person that you're searching on? And who really is operating this site? Is it an anonymous name? Or one of these people that hides behind anonymity on the internet and uses that site to then badmouth somebody? So, in other words, you're searching on my name and you go to their site, or is it a site that's trying to sell something? They know I get a lot of hits on my webpage, so they go, gee, if we somehow put McCanny's name up here, and when you search on his name, people will mistakenly go to our site, then that's just another form of false reporting in search engines. So you're starting to get the picture, and so what I'm suggesting is that there should be a code that comes up along with that search engine. So when you look at a listing that pops up for Jim McCanny, you realize and you can click on that and say, who's paying for this site? And you go back, and it would have to be someone who is registered, and you would see, oh, this is the CIA site. The CIA is paying for this site. It is not authorized by McCanny. It is bad-mouthing him and giving false information, and there have been requests to have this removed because it's derogatory and inflammatory. And you could see who owns that site and who's paying for it. Now, you see what I'm talking about? That currently does not exist on the internet or in the search engines, and that information should be made available. You have kids going to the internet and they type in, you know, some name of something they want to find out about, and you have porno sites or something coming up with that name because people know that kids will search on that name. So the internet rating system is very necessary, and I liken it to walking in. What if you walked into a grocery store and you went to the meat counter and every package had meat, those four letters stamped on it, and you picked up the package and it had a wrapper around it so you couldn't see what was in there. So you picked up the package and you didn't know what was in there till you got home and opened it up and there it was in your house. And you don't know who put it there, where it came from, or what's in the package. That's what the internet is like today. Okay, RF Chips. The state of Washington, in conjunction with Homeland Security, has installed computer RF frequency computer chips in their driver's license. And gee, you can volunteer to get one of these if you want. But what happens if you lose your driver's license? Well, I guess the next solution will be just to put it on your forehead. At any rate, RF chips are coming. They're coming in all directions to a house or a person near you. This week, 50 years of space since the Sputnik was launched by Russia. 50 years in space. So I want to comment quickly on where we are and what has happened with the space program. Let's go back to the year 1967. A movie called 2001 Space Odyssey came out. Stanley Kubrick. It showed in the widescreen theaters, and it was what everybody expected. We would be there by the year 2000 with this orbiting space station being built and travel to the moon, bases on the moon, and exploration going on all around us. Space travel was commonplace. You flew up there in an aircraft that took off from a runway. You had vending machines, and you had artificial gravity. Remember that our space station has nothing like artificial gravity, even. How primitive. A couple cans stuck together. They call it a space station. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So After 50 years of space and $1 trillion, the equivalent of our national debt, NASA is still relying on a 30-year-old piece of junk space shuttle that cannot take off and cannot get people into space. Remember that there's, I believe it's a, is it a Russian lady that's up there? No, she's U.S., that's right. And she's going to set a record because they can't get up there and get her. Is this amazing? So I want to ask the question. I'd like to know how many corporate aerospace executive homes have been built from the space station, from the space program. How many extremely rich stockholders do we have because of our aerospace program? Space is not about going into space. It's about corporate profits. Make no mistake. When you go to a meeting or if you look at something in Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine, you can see underlying everything that's happening there, profit, profit, profit. Scientists, engineers working on programs, and they all look towards the government as their main source of revenue, profit, profit, profit. And end result, here we are in 2007, and really no end in sight. Also, I want to comment on Hollywood being used to promote standard science. We're going to see more and more of this, where standard scientific explanations are being promoted in Hollywood movies, sometimes even using scientists as props, making it, as they say in some of the headlines, sexy and etc. But what's really happening is there's a standard in vogue set of scientific standards that will be pushed onto the public through Hollywood hype and movies. Saturn, it was in the news this week, a very large hexagonal pattern found at the North Pole, and scientists scrambling to try and understand what exactly is happening there. At the North Pole of Saturn is a vortex that looks very much like a hurricane on Earth, and rotating high winds, etc. So what exactly is happening at the North Pole of Saturn? I did want to talk about this and relate it to the South Pole hurricane-type pattern that exists on Saturn. Well, first of all, the South Pole at this time of Saturn is pointed towards the Sun. That's the side that gets the electron beam as Saturn, as with comets, discharges the solar capacitor. The north side of Saturn, the one that points in the northerly direction, the same direction as our North Pole, pointing up out of the solar system, so to speak, has a hexagonal pattern. And you can see these pictures on the internet. They're on the many websites and news agencies have shown this. But here's what's going on. The vortex at the South Pole, which is pointed towards the Sun, receives a single electron beam. And that beam is concentrated down the center of that vortex. That's what drives the vortex. And it's a single beam. That's the key here. On the Northern Pole, which is pointed away from the Sun at this time, and that will change in about 15 years, and then the South Pole will then be pointed away from the Sun, and the North Pole will then point towards the Sun. It should show these patterns where basically you have comet tail type electromagnetic structures attaching to small storms. And if you look closely at the pattern, the hexagonal pattern at the South Pole, here's what you will see. At the six corners of the pattern, at each corner, you're going to find a small hurricane-type storm. That extends the wind flow patterns out around those vortex storms. And in fact, that is what is causing the wind patterns to look somewhat like a hexagon. Now, you might say, well, why six? Why not five or seven or 12 or three? Well, there again, these systems, I would say that someday we'll probably see other planets if we go to other solar systems and we'll see these types of patterns, but there might be 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 poles, so to speak, and instead of a hexagonal pattern, we'll see a pentagon or some other number of sided flow patterns around the storms that hover around the South Pole. And this is typical because on the non-sunward side, you have many connecting electrical paths out to the far end of the solar system. These are the ions, the positive ions that are coming in. And so there are multiple tails, just like we see many comets. For example, Hale-Bopp, I forget how many tails it had at one time. I think as many as 14 different tails at one time. So it's the same type of thing. The tails, you have multiple tails coming in from the non-sunward side, but only a single electron beam coming in from the sunward side. Just a quick mention, the Marshall Islands this week announced a drought, a severe drought, and they are in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Now, how on earth, they said they have a ship going there. Two issues. We have giant icebergs breaking off of Antarctica at the South Pole. These, I've said all along, should be maneuvered, cut into pieces with large lasers, and moved, usually with sail power, they could be moved up to islands like this where they need fresh water. Second of all, desalination. Is that a word that you've ever heard of? Israel, that country in the Mideast, which we pour a tremendous amount of money into every year, has desalination. They run their entire country off of desalination. They even plant their crops using desalinated ocean water. So what's the problem with the Marshall Islands? How come, as a protectorate of the United States, have we not shared this technology and this benefit with the people of the Marshall Islands? They're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and they're claiming to have a water shortage. Imagine how bizarre that is. But this water issue is going to get more bizarre as the years and months proceed. There, you're going to see more and more about water shortages, and the disinformation in this entire article revolves around the fact that they're trying to convince people that an island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean could have a water shortage. Main topic I want to talk about tonight, and I only have a few minutes left, but I do have time to get this in. It goes back to the prime numbers, and the question is, what are the most important numbers? And now that seems to be kind of a strange question, and this is something I think kids should think about, and adults, and mathematicians. What are the most important numbers? Are there any numbers that are more important than any other numbers? If you look at my Calculate Primes book and the method for calculating the prime numbers, you start with the numbers 0 and 1. And, of course, the prime numbers are the building blocks for all the other numbers. And then once you get those numbers, you can generate the fractions and the real numbers and all of the other numbers that we use. So, if you can generate all the prime numbers starting with just 0 and 1, then it would seem, as a number theorist and as the average guy on the street, that the most important numbers are 0 and 1. With those two numbers, we can generate all the other numbers. In a number theory, a mathematical course which you would typically take at the university level, it's a course I've taught many times, you start with 0 and 1, and actually to develop the natural numbers, you simply start with 1. And these have their basis actually in some very esoteric branches of symbolic logic, another course that I've taught at the university level. Symbolic logic uses just symbols and elements to build up what we call, then we then name this the natural numbers, the natural numbers are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., up to infinity. When you add 0 and the negative numbers, negative 1, negative 2, etc., you get what we call the integers. And then you start working with those. You get the real numbers. You can have rational numbers, which are fractions of integers. And then you can create numbers called complex numbers, and there are actually more complicated sets of numbers beyond that. So at any rate, if you can generate all of the other number systems starting with just 0 and 1, then it would stand to reason that those are the most important numbers in existence, because everything else flows from them. All of the other number systems are based on them. And if you were, I've talked about the concept of repeatability. If you're on the far side of the solar system and or the far side of the universe, and you are a being that's starting to create a number system, you're starting to become intelligent, you're starting to count things, you're starting to put things in rows and columns, you're starting to discover the prime numbers, eventually you're going to come up with that same fundamental question. What are the essential building blocks of these number systems? And the answer that they would ultimately have to come to is the same answer that we would give here on planet Earth in our little corner of the universe. The most important numbers are 0 and 1. And of course, that is the basis also for the binary number system. The most rudimentary number system in existence just uses zeros and ones. And all the other number systems can be translated from binary. We use binary systems in computers. All of the computer logic that is built up based on gates, electronics, and transistors, micro-sized transistors in an array, used in computers, 0 and 1 are in fact the basis for all of computer language, the binary number system. So it would be safe to say, and kids, maybe you should talk about this in your math classes, what do you think would be the most important numbers? And there are some other very important numbers. The number 6 is very important. When you start dealing with the prime numbers, 6 turns out to be an extremely important number. 3 and 2 are very important numbers, and remember that 6 is the product of 2 times 3, which are also prime numbers. So at any rate, asking, and 2 and 3 can be generated starting with just 0 and 1. It's one of the procedures I go through in the Calculate Primes book. Now, once again, mathematicians spend lifetimes laboring over these details, and the book is written for the general public, so we don't go into all of those details in the book. They're kind of glossed over for the general public. But I guarantee you, mathematicians will spend many years dealing with just that issue alone. At any rate, I am once again out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.